We've got a little bit to finish off in the preliminaries, the foundation practices. So I'd like to finish that in this session. But again, we'll begin with a meditation. And yesterday we, as the meditation, we went through these prayers for meditation. We sort of reflected on these points to go through. And I'd like to go through that again today, maybe a little bit more quickly than we did yesterday, but just so to, again, to get familiar with the steps. And then having done this preparation at the beginning of meditation, then we'll have a little bit of time to do an actual meditation. And what I'd like to do is continue the awareness of awareness practice that we've been doing. So again, that's going to be the meditation, is I'll guide you through these steps here, and then we'll go into an awareness of awareness meditation for the rest of the session. Okay? And then we'll finish off our discussion on the preliminary practices. So finding a nice comfortable posture. We begin by preparing the body. Good posture, so back nice and straight, and body completely relaxed. Bringing the mind into the present moment, not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future, simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Then we can begin by reflecting on the four thoughts. The four thoughts that turn the mind toward practice, a more meaningful life. We can reflect on each of these points briefly. This precious life of leisure and opportunity is rare and easily lost. The world and those within it are impermanent. I too will die soon. The results of my virtuous and non-virtuous actions will without fail ripen within me. And there is no genuine happiness to be found within the abodes of samsara. Therefore, I must correctly practice the true Dharma. To have a door of entry and a support for that, we can go for refuge and generate bodhicitta. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By my practice of giving in other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May they never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. And may they abide in equanimity, free from attachment and aversion to those near and far. And then imagine your teacher has come to meditate with you, and they're seated in front of you. If you don't have a teacher, then imagine someone who you highly respect and regard, and imagine they're meditating with you. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. So mentally bow down to all those wonderful qualities that the person in front of you has, qualities that you would like to cultivate. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. So we can make offerings to this person in front of us. The greatest offering we can give them is our practice, following their advice. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time. So think of a non-virtuous action that you've done recently and declare this openly to this person and cultivate sincere regret for having done that action and make a strong determination not to do it again. And I rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. So rejoice in the actions of this person seated in front of you, their virtuous actions, how they're benefiting the world. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. So make a strong request that they continue to guide you in your practice and that they continue to be in your life. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the great enlightenment. And then make a request to the teacher in front of you that they inspire and guide you in the Mahamudra practice, in this practice. They hear your request and they're very happy to help you in your practice. And so imagine that they dissolve into light. And this light merges with the light of Buddha nature at your heart. and they're present with you in your meditation, inspiring and guiding you. And then allowing your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you, releasing all appearances, and simply rest in the experience of awareness itself. And in conclusion, we can dedicate the virtue of having done this meditation due to the merits of these virtuous actions. May I quickly attain a state of enlightenment and lead all sentient beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. So we'll go back and finish off the last of the preliminaries. So back on page one of the text, we saw that there are these four guiding instructions, these four what's called uncommon or special preliminaries: refuge and bodhicitta, vajrasattva meditation, mandala offering, and guru yoga. And we saw that those are the preliminary practices to the tantra level of Mahamudra, and that we have equivalent practices at the level of sutra, level of Mahamudra. And yesterday we looked at briefly the first three. We already previously looked at refuge bodhicitta. We looked at Vajrasattva meditation. The purpose of this, of course, is to purify the mind of negativities, and that the core element of Vajrasattva practice, particularly when we look at sutra level, is these four opponent powers: regret, reliance, remedy, resolve. These four powers we can use to purify the mind of negativities. And here, Vajrasattva meditation is a way of packaging those four opponent powers. And these four preliminaries in Tibetan tradition, traditionally often people do 100,000 repetitions of them. So often the refuge and bodhicitta verse, they would recite 100,000 times while doing prostrations. The second one, the Vajrasattva meditation, they would go through this Vajrasattva practice through the four opponent powers, reciting the Vajrasattva mantra 100,000 times. Mandala offering was a way of accumulating virtue, merit. And so we would do these 100,000 times, this mandala offering. And then the last one, which we're going to look at today, is the guru yoga. The guru yoga is for the purpose of receiving inspiration and for, at the tantric level particularly, planting the seed of wisdom in our mind. From the teacher plants a seed of wisdom in our mind. So guru yoga, of course, is a complete practice in itself. And why to practice it? I'd like to read a little bit from His Holiness's book on this Gelug Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra. In the book, it's page 183, and in the PDF file, it's page 105. And he says the following here. He says, "Next, as a portal for inspiration to cascade upon us, we practice guru yoga. In general, in order to gain realization and actualize any constructive pathways of mind, we need a strong inspiration on our mind stream that can only come from our spiritual teacher. And particularly here, the guru's inspiration is especially important for gaining realization of Mahamudra. I know several Kagyu and Dzogchen practitioners who have attested to this from their own personal experience. They had received discourses on Mahamudra or Dzogchen from their gurus and had everything assembled to enable them to meditate. But only when they had brought to consciousness their extraordinary respect and incomparable faith in their guru was their mind exhilarated and stimulated enough so that they were able to see in that state the nature of their mind. They told me that their fervent regard for their guru brought to their practice very special experiences and strong conviction. Thus we conclude that for gaining realization of constructive states of mind in general, and especially for gaining special realizations on our mind stream in connection with the practice of Anuttara Yoga Tantra, it is definite that we need special inspiration from our gurus to fill our mind stream. Guru Yoga is explained as the portal for that inspiration to cascade upon us. So I think that's some very good advice there from His Holiness Dalai Lama. Now, if we go to the part in our text relating to this Guru Yoga, on page 2, the very last paragraph in the preliminary section before the actual practice, it says here, "Then from the depths of your heart, make repeated requests to your root guru, who is kind in three ways, seeing them as inseparable from all the Buddhas of the three times, past, present, future, or as the essence of the three jewels combined, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha." So here it talks about root guru. Remember the word guru here means someone who's qualified teacher of tantra. So who is a root guru? What is a root guru? And a root guru, generally, they is said that they're kind to us in three ways. We see here the three kindnesses. So the root guru is someone who's kind to us in three ways. The first way they're kind, of course, is they introduce us to the tantric practice. So they give empowerment. Sometimes called initiation. So an empowerment, of course, is introducing us into the practice. And of course, there are many various tantric practices. And so when they give an empowerment, then of course they need to explain that particular tantra, that practice, so we can do the practice. So the second way they're kind to us is they explain the tantra, the practice. So that could be an explanation of how to do the Tara practice, the Yamantaka, Manjushi, many. So they would explain that particular tantra, that practice. But the third way in which they would be kind would be to give us personal instructions on how to do that practice. They would give us personal instructions. So as we see in the text, it says the root guru is the one who has been kind to us in three ways. And so these are the three kindnesses. And I mentioned before that we had the different lineages in the Kagyu tradition. I mentioned that one of those lineages was called the Shangpa Kagyu. And one of the modern day masters well known from the Shangpa Kagyu is Kalu Rinpoche. And I have a little quote from Kalu Rinpoche. He says, "The root lama," so remember, lama is the Tibetan word for guru, "is the one who causes us to recognize the nature of our mind. They are the source of the blessings that introduce us to Mahamudra, the ultimate nature of the mind. They show us how to recognize our mind as the Dharmakaya." So this is what he says. So remember, in Guru Yoga, Guru Yoga is a complete practice having many steps. Here, at the sutra level of this practice, the guru yoga, or what we're doing is we're visualizing and then we're making these requests, as we did in the meditation, requests to the guru, to the teacher. Make repeated requests to your root gurus, kindness and three, seeing him as inseparable from all the Buddhas of the three times or as the essence of the three jewels combined. So, therefore, it's very important to have conviction and faith in the teacher. On that point, His Holiness Dalai Lama also is commenting, so I'd like to read that out as well. On page 122 in the PDF. The most important point in the practice of guru yoga is to have respect and confident belief in our guru or spiritual master. As a result of this respectful faith, we receive a steady flow of inspiration from our guru, filling our mind stream, serving as the basis for gaining insight and realization. At the beginning, do we start our Buddha's teachings simply on the basis of faith alone? Definitely no, we do not. It is not that way at all. Out of faith and wisdom, wisdom or discerning awareness is the more important. And here he talks about the four reliances. Buddha's scriptural texts stress the four reliances. Concerning a teacher, do not rely simply on the person, but on the Dharma measures that he or she imparts. So don't just rely on the person, but rely on their teaching. So that's the first reliance. Concerning those measures, do not simply rely on their words, but on their meaning. So don't rely on the words, but rely on the meaning that they give. Concerning that meaning, do not rely simply on their interpretable meaning, but that leads to deeper, but on their definitive meaning to which they lead. Therefore, don't rely on the surface meaning, but the deepest meaning, what those texts lead us toward. And for understanding that definitive level of meaning, do not rely on ordinary consciousness, but deep awareness. So don't rely simply on intellectual knowledge, but rely on direct experience, on realization. So these are the four reliances that he's talking about. So they come up very commonly. Thus, discriminating deep awareness is extremely important for Buddhist practice. We must examine every point of the Dharma teachings with logic and reason. We only accept what accords with reason and makes sense, and never accept anything that is illogical or makes no sense. Thus, reason and understanding are totally essential and required. And then also, he has more advice regarding what to do if you have no teacher or guru, what to do if you find that you have the wrong guru, the wrong teacher, and what to do if you prematurely jump into tantra level of practice when you're not ready. So he has some good advice for those three cases, so I'd like to read it out. So first, what to do if you have no guru or teacher. So this is on page 107. Often in non-traditionally Buddhist countries, such as in the West, we do not have great access to many spiritual teachers. The Buddhist masters who visit may come only once a year at the most. Thus, it is difficult to find a sufficient variety of gurus to investigate for us to be able to select a proper one, and there are insufficient opportunities to examine the qualifications of any of them. But this does not mean that before we have found a teacher who can serve as our guru or even as our root guru, we cannot begin our Dharma practice and at least engage in some of the forward-leading preliminaries. First of all, we can certainly receive teachings from various spiritual instructors who visit our countries and do so in the manner of simply attending a lecture. As for engaging in meditation practices, even without a root guru, we can proceed on the basis of receiving instructions in a lecture or reading a book to practice, for example, the four close placements of mindfulness on the body, the feelings, the mind and phenomena. We can also begin without a root guru to practice the meditation methods for developing the dedicated heart of bodhicitta and a correct understanding of nature of reality on the basis of reading such texts as Shantideva's Engaging in the Bodhisattva's Deeds. However, before we can engage in any meditation practice, we must first ponder and think over carefully what we have heard or read so we understand it correctly. Now, what to do if we find that we've taken a teacher and somehow we find this is not the right person, maybe they're even being a little bit unethical. So what should we do in that case? So we'll have a look at that. So this is on page 122. In some cases, it happens that disciples do not examine a spiritual teacher very carefully before they accept him or her as their guru and committing themselves to a guru-disciple relationship. They may even have received tantric empowerments from this teacher, but then they find they were wrong. They see many flaws in this teacher and discover many serious mistakes he or she has made. They find that this teacher does not really suit them. Their mind is uneasy regarding this person and they are filled with doubts and possibly regret. What to do in such a circumstance? The mistake, of course, is that originally the disciples did not examine this teacher very carefully before committing themselves to him or her. But this is something of the past that has already happened. No one can change that. In the future, of course, they must examine any potential guru much more thoroughly. But as for what to do in this particular situation with this particular guru, it is not productive or helpful to continue investigating and scrutinizing him or her in terms of suspicions or doubts. But rather, as the Kala Chakra Tantra recommends, it is best to keep a respectful distance. They should just forget about him or her and not have anything further to do with this person. It is not healthy, of course, for disciples to deny serious ethical flaws in their guru, if they are in fact true, or his or her involvement in Buddhist power politics, if this is the case. To do so would be a total loss of discriminating awareness. But for disciples to dwell in their mind on these points with disrespect, self-recrimination, regret, and other negative attitudes is not only unnecessary, unhelpful, and unproductive, it is also improper. They distance themselves even further from achieving a peaceful state of mind and may seriously jeopardize their future spiritual progress. I think it best in this circumstance just to forget about this teacher. I think that's some very good advice. And unfortunately, this happens a lot in our modern society, that people in a big rush to have a guru, and then they see someone charismatic, and maybe this person's got a lot of disciples already, and they immediately jump in, take empowerment, and then suddenly they realize, well, hang on, this person is actually not so ethical. And then they sort of feel a bit stuck because they feel like they have taken empowerment and we still have to follow them somehow. But I think His Holiness Vice has very good advice there, what to do. Just forget about them. Have nothing more to do with that person. And then the last point is, and that is often the case, is people jump in and then often they take empowerments, you know, tantric empowerments. And of course, empowerments often come with some sort of daily commitment. So what to do if somehow you've jumped in, taken these empowerments and committed yourself to all these practices and then you find that you can't do them or you're not ready for them? What to do in that case? So again, His Holiness has very good advice for that on page 123 in your PDF. He says, it may also occur that disciples have taken tantric empowerments prematurely, thinking that Tantra is famous as being so high, it must be beneficial to take this initiation. They feel they are ready for this step and take the empowerment, thereby committing themselves to the master, conferring it as now being their tantric guru. Moreover, they commit themselves as well to various sets of vows and a daily recitation meditation practice, sadhana. Later, these disciples realize that this style of practice does not suit them at all, and again they are filled with doubts, regret, and possibly fear. Again, what to do? We can understand this with an analogy. Suppose, for instance, we go to a store, we see something useful, but an exotic item that strikes our fancy and just buy it on impulse, even though it is costly. When we bring it home, we find, after examining the item more soberly, now that we are out of the exciting, seductive atmosphere of the glittering store, that we have no particular use for it at the moment. In such a situation, it is best not to throw the thing out in the garbage, but rather to put it aside. Later, we might find, in fact, it very useful. The same conclusion applies to the commitments disciples have taken prematurely at a tantric empowerment without sufficient examination to determine if they are ready for them. In such situation, rather than throwing the whole thing away in the trash and deciding that they are never going to use it at all, such disciples would be better to establish a neutral attitude toward it, putting Tantra and their commitments aside and leaving it like that. This is because they may come back to them later and find them very precious and useful. Suppose, however, disciples have taken an empowerment and have accepted the commitment to practice the meditation of a particular Buddha figure by reciting a sadhana, a method of actualization, to guide them through a complex sequence of visualization and mantra repetition. Although they still have faith in Tantra, they find that their recitation commitment is too long and has a great burden and strain to maintain it as a daily practice. What to do then? Such disciples should abbreviate their practice. This is very different from the previous case in which certain disciples find that tantric practice in general does not suit them at the present stage of their spiritual life. Everyone has time each day to eat and to sleep. Likewise, no matter how busy they are, no matter how many family and business responsibilities they may have, such disciples can at least find a few minutes to maintain their daily continuity of generating themselves in the imagination of the aspect of the Buddha figure and reciting the appropriate mantra. They must make some effort. Disciples can never progress anywhere on the spiritual path if they do not make at least a minimal amount of effort. I think there's some good advice there too. Okay, so I just wanted to mention those things because often many people find themselves in this situation either with no teacher or they pick a wrong teacher or they jump into tantric practices prematurely and make all these commitments and then what to do. And then they're full of doubts and difficulties. So any questions about the Guru Yoga or anything I've just read?
I have read some different advice, maybe from not from the teachers, but from other teachers, not teachers actually, I read it somewhere, that it doesn't matter how your guru looked, or doesn't matter how what? Independently how your guru looked, his behavior, if it looked good or not to you, and even doesn't matter how little importance was of that teacher, for example, even the teacher in your high school, for example, if you don't regard them with respect, it might be an obstacle for achieving realizations. And one same people was, it was an example cited, one of the well-known people was meditating somewhere in the cave and keeping the chief realizations just because he forgot one small guru.
Right. So what's your point or question? I didn't catch it.
I mean, advice to forget completely the guru, it looks a little bit like,
No, but you're talking about the case where the guru doesn't have the qualities that you thought. Here, he's talking about a guru who is unethical. So there's a big difference there. What you're saying is that even a guru who has very limited qualities, if we show respect and faith, we can achieve realization. This is, I think, your point. He's not talking about that. He's talking about actually someone who's being unethical. In that case, to do this would be the wrong thing to do. And unfortunately, this is what people do. They jump in, not only do they find the guru is not qualified, but they find them actually engaging in non-virtuous, unethical behavior. Then to continue with this would be the wrong way forward. So that's what His Holiness is saying, is that if they're engaging in unethical behavior, then you need to cut from that teacher. What you're talking about, I think, is more you go in and the teacher doesn't have a lot of high qualities, but they're still trying to help you. Often, of course, what we do in our modern society, if someone's not highly advanced and they've only got a few qualities, we then say, oh, they can't help us, they're not very good, you know. And then, of course, we don't benefit. And I think the point you were trying to make is that even if that guru only has a few qualities, if we have respect for them, then we can still benefit from that person. And so then we can continue to benefit from that person, even though they're not highly qualified. So I think these are two different points here. Because even if the teacher is highly qualified, our tendency is to often, you know, if someone has a lot of qualities and then they have one or two tiny faults, that's what we focus on. So even, you know, maybe it's some very high teacher and maybe they have no faults and we just project something, but we latch on to that and we go, oh, you know, oh, no. And we focus on that. And then, of course, even though they're highly qualified, because we're focusing on that fault and not respecting them, we don't benefit. Whereas if we have a teacher who has much less qualities, but we have respect and faith in them, we can benefit from that person. So this, I think, is the point you were trying to make. The respect and faith in the guru, regardless of whether they have a lot of qualities, only a few qualities. But here His Holiness is talking about the different case of an unethical, someone who's really unethical. Maybe financially and even sexually exploiting students, then we need to cut from that teacher.
And we have more than one guru. And so what makes a guru a guru?
Yeah, this. This is the root guru.
If one fails, then it's not a guru, yeah?
Sorry?
Without personal instructions, it's not a guru.
I mean, I think the word root guru is someone that you are personally relying on in your, and so particularly the third point.
But sometimes you think that you're relying, but maybe your teacher doesn't think that he's relying on you.
I think at this level, there's usually either explicit or implicit arrangement in terms of the relationship and the fact that they are giving you personal instruction. So usually it's fairly clear whether or not that's the case. And sometimes, often it's explicit, you know, the student will explicitly ask the teacher, can you be my personal teacher? So often it's very explicit. And then if the teacher says yes, it's clear. Teacher says no, it's clear. So usually it's done like that. Particularly in the Tibetan tradition, it tends to be often quite formal in that way. You make a formal request. So, and then there was something else, I think.
About you.
Oh, yeah. So, again, the general recommendation is to only have one personal teacher. So, of course, we can have a number of teachers that we receive teachings from, But when it comes to personal instructions, it's generally recommended just to have one. Because the problem is that if we have two teachers who give personal instructions and they seemingly give contradictory instructions, then what do? That's one problem. Another problem is that often if we go to a teacher asking for personal advice, quite often the very thing that they're going to ask us to do is the one thing we don't want to do because it's the one thing we need to work on. And so we hear this and we go, oh, no, I don't want to do that. And so we go off to someone else and ask someone else, what shall I do? And they probably say the same thing. We go, oh, no. And then we run off and eventually, until someone says something nice, that's not in our best interest. So therefore, best to have one. And generally, if you go to someone for personal advice, and they may ask you if you have a personal guru already, and if you say yes, most likely they'll say, follow their advice. Follow their advice. Don't come to me. And then there was one more point I wanted to mention there, but now it's also slipped my mind. Yes. When asking for personal instructions, I think the best attitude is to don't ask unless you're prepared to follow the advice. Of course, if the advice is unethical, we must not follow it. But there's no point going to a teacher asking for personal advice if we're not prepared to follow it. Then we're just kidding ourselves. Then we don't have faith and respect for them. So I think this is a good attitude to have, is, you know, to only ask personal advice if we're prepared to actually follow it. Then, because then we'll benefit. If not, then it's a waste of time. You're wasting their time, you're wasting your time. Again, root guru is often it's explained this way, someone who gives you the personal instruction. So you may, if you're practicing a tantra, you may receive teachings from various teachers with this. You know, maybe they give empowerment and they explain tantra to you. You have a number of different tantric practices, but then the one who really is giving the personal instructions. So, and this usually is with respect to your main practice as well, often.
Or on the sutra level, there are no gurus? Or it's just...
Generally within Buddhism, if we talk sutra level, if you like going to the Lam Rim and it talks about relying on the teacher, generally you don't see the word guru. In the text, they use the Sanskrit word is Kalyana Mitra, which is translated as virtuous spiritual friend. Often you see that in the Lam Rim. And Kalyana Mitra in Tibetan is Geshe. Ge is short for Gewa, meaning virtue. She is short for Shenyan, meaning friend. So Geshe is a virtuous spiritual friend. But what we need to be aware of is nowadays, Geshe is simply an academic title. A monk, or now nuns as well, if they do a lot of study, usually 10 to 20 years of study, and they pass some sort of academic exam, they're given the title Geshe. So nowadays, we should not assume that if someone's called Geshe this, Geshe that, that they're a qualified teacher. We need to check them out. Historically, in early days of Buddhism in Tibet, you know, the Kadampa Geshe's, you know, Geshe Langri Tampa, Geshe Chikawa, they didn't have academic titles. They were qualified teachers. That's why they were called Geshe.
So if you are not practicing Tantra, and you may have kind of teacher, but there is no such a commitment.
Again, at the level of sutra, you can have a personal teacher. And then often there's a commitment because your commitment is to follow their advice. Commitments in terms of vows doesn't come from the teacher. It comes from the empowerment in Tantra, or it comes from specifically taking the Bodhisattva vows or the Pratimoksha vows. So that's where the commitments come from. But again, if you have a personal teacher, then, and you ask for advice, then, you know, you should follow their advice, otherwise you're wasting their time, you know. And then we have a tea break.
Can that empowerment really work without personal instructions?
So the empowerment, and as we saw in the Tantra section, there can be four different empowerments. And at Tantra, there were two stages of practice, generation stage, completion stage. The first empowerment of the four empowers us to do generation stage. The other three empower us to do completion stage practice. So, of course, if we only go to an empowerment and don't even receive this explanation, which is often the case, let alone any personal instructions, what are we going to do? I mean, we go and we get a Yamantaka empowerment. Now what? I mean, it's a waste of time. So, you know, at least we need to get this, because without this we can't do the practice. You know, I mean, we can't do the practice. And then, of course, if we have this, then we can do that practice most effectively according to our disposition, our level. So at the minimum would be to receive this. Otherwise, what are we going to do? I mean, maybe we get the empowerment and someone gives us a copy of the sadhana and then we look at it. I mean, what are we going to do? We can, of course, mimic the words. We can recite all the words in the sadhana. But is that really going to help us? Probably not much. In fact, we're probably going to get frustrated in having to recite all these words because often they're quite long. We probably don't have much idea about what's going on and what we're supposed to do. And so then not much benefit. I mean, of course, if we've got endless amount of time, okay, but, you know, we don't have endless amount of time. We want to be effective in our practice. So if we're spending, you know, an hour or two reading through some sadhana that we have no idea what it means, I mean, is that an effective use of time? I don't think so. I think we can do more effective practices than just merely reading through a sadhana that we have no idea what it means.
Explanations too can be, they can be very different. Some could be very brief, some could be some...
This explaining the Tantra? Yeah, sure. But at least we should have a sort of basic instruction about what all the parts of the sadhana are and what they mean and how to do them. I mean, at least that. And then, of course, we can get much more elaborate. But if we don't have that and we do an empowerment, then often people don't even... They just do an empowerment, they didn't... That's it. Particularly if the empowerment comes with commitments... And then we don't do them, that's not good. Sometimes you can go to an empowerment as what's called a blessing. You know, often like His Holiness does the Kala Chakra empowerments, you know, these big events in many places in the world. And for about 99.9% of the people there, it's just a blessing. They're not actually taking the empowerment. So sometimes you can go to an empowerment as a blessing, and maybe to have a little bit of a connection with the teacher. But often, if the teacher's really giving the empowerment properly, then usually they'll start the empowerment with an explanation, not this, but a general explanation and one to sort of get people motivated. And often they'll allow anyone to come to that because it's just a general talk. But then when they start the empowerment, they say, okay, anyone who's not taking the empowerment, you have to leave now. You're not allowed to stay, you have to leave. And sometimes from the very beginning, they'll say only people who are taking the empowerment can come. The rest, no. So it depends on the teacher and how it's done.
Which is like students of
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah, sure,
sure. I mean, exactly, because this takes quite a lot of time, and often the high-level teachers don't have the time to do that. So at least it's better if you get an empowerment from a high-level teacher and then someone else gives that explanation versus you don't get it at all. So yes, that, I mean, ideally, the teacher, the person who's doing that should do this and this. I mean, the reality to get all three is not so easy. So at least if we get empowerment to get, at least get an explanation of the Tantra from someone sort of qualified, at least that, that's sort of the minimum. Otherwise, what's the point of doing the empowerment when we don't know anything about the practice? Okay, let's break there. It's afternoon tea break. And in the next session, of course, we'll go back into the Vipassana practice.